Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Welcome to episode 2 of Still Watching Falcon and the Winter Soldier. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
If you are just joining us for the first time on Still Watching, what we like to do on the show is that Richard and I like to pick a show that we're watching kind of closely, break it down week by week. Sometimes we have folks who work on the show come on the show on this podcast and talk to us about it. Sometimes we don't. This week we don't. So it's just going to be us, our sweet opinions and thoughts and theories. And if you stick around for the back half of the show, that is when our colleague Anthony Brezkin will show up to get dive a little deeper into some comic lore, get a little nerdier about some theories and stuff like that. So we will be doing that in the back half of the show. We also love to get your input. You can always email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We're going to get to a couple of those. But first, really quickly, I want to let you know that we've got this really cool thing coming up that Vanity Fair is doing April 13th to the 15th. It's called Cocktail Hour. And Richard, I'm about to blow your hair back with some of the guests. Are you ready?
Okay. Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay. We've got Serena Williams, Gal Gadot, Michael B. Jordan, Glenn Close, Laura Dern, John Hamm, Amanda Seyfried, Paris Hilton, Andy Samberg, Lonely Island, Chaka King, Jessica Alba, and more to be announced. Also, the girl band that I just recently found out I was mispronouncing. It's Haim, right? Not Haim, as like a lot of people said. Anyway.
Sure.
These are some of the guests. This is going to be like this cool festival we're doing. We're doing In Conversations. There's going to be like fun games that they're playing, music, all sorts of stuff. And a portion of the proceeds will go to the Motion Picture and Television Fund to help support COVID-19 relief efforts. The tickets are available right now at vf.com/live. So you can go pick us some tickets, check out the events, see what's going on. I think it's going to be something really cool that we're doing. In the end of this pandemic here, the last gasp of our stay-at-home order. What are you most excited for this Cocktail Hour, Richard?
Well, you mentioned Chaka King, who, you know, directed Judas and the Black Messiah. I believe that he is in conversation with Ziwe, the comedian and actor and writer who has an Instagram live show that she's been doing kind of, I think, since the pandemic started, where she asks people some tough questions. I think that'll be really interesting. But yeah, I think there's such a breadth. The Paris Hilton conversation, I believe she's talking with our own Emily Jane Fox, who is a really interesting chronicler of, you know, that sort of contingent of American wealth and society, a critical cover of it. She's not Emily has her own takes on things. So anyway, there's a night's breadth of subject matter, and it should be fun.
And our very own of this podcast, Anthony Breskin, will be talking to Wonder Woman herself, Gal Gadot. So go to vf.com/live. Pick up your tickets. Join us for this very fun thing that we're doing. All right. So, Richard Lawson, mm-hmm. Do we have any emails that you want to dive into this week?
I, in fact, have three emails.
Three.
Hit me. I have selected from the button bag like Tim Gunn. So a couple of them wade into stuff that maybe you and Anthony are better suited to talk about, but they piqued my interest as, you know, I this set of the comic book world, I don't know anything about. Like, I know a little bit about X-Men and some Avenger stuff we've seen on screen, but like Captain America lore is, I never really followed that character. Mm-hmm. So the first email is from, this is less comic book nerdy, from Paul. And he writes and says, thank you for your continued coverage of the Marvel TV productions. And he has a couple questions that listeners may have asked, but here we go. First is, do we have a rough estimate for when this TV show is set? I'm assuming post-WandaVision, but how far after? Do you think we may have Sam and Bucky comment at all regarding what happened in Westview? So let's just answer these one by one. I don't know. Do you know the answer to that?
Okay. Yes. It's been 6 months since the blip we found out in episode one. So for context of the post-Endgame stuff we've seen, Spider-Man Far From Home takes place 8 months. That's, you know, Spider-Man's European vacation took place 8 months. So 2 months after the events of the show, after the blip. And then WandaVision took place only a couple weeks after the blip. So well in advance of what we're seeing here. It would be interesting to see them comment on it. But given what we know about how WandaVision was supposed to premiere after this, I don't know. I don't know, in terms of reshoots and stuff, if we'll see them comment on it. But it does seem weird. This is one thing that the Marvel Universe sometimes has issues with, which is like siloing off various heroes' adventures from each other. I'm pretty sure that's why Captain Marvel, played by Brie Larson, just like goes into space after the 90s. So that they don't have to explain why she wasn't like at the Battle of New York and other things. So this is part of the complication when you populate your planet with superheroes. Why don't they all show up for all the big battles, you know? So.
Well, in Captain Marvel's case, it was proving that, you know, we have a very Earth-centric view of things, Joanna. There were other problems to attend to in the universe, and the Battle
other
of New York just didn't rate, you know?
<It's> like other planets than yours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Paul continues. Are we as viewers to believe that Sam Wilson was not compensated for his efforts as an Avenger? Or is he just, quote, cash poor after being blipped the last 5 years? So that's a reference, obviously, to the scenes in the first episode where he and his sister are struggling to save their family fishing business. They go to the bank. They are turned down quite, you know, officiously for a loan. There was another email that suggested, well, wouldn't Tony Stark have set up like a heroes fund or something? That seems like something Tony Stark would have done in his more generous later years. So I don't know. What is the conventional thinking on the finances of Sam or the Avengers in general?
Yeah, I think this actually wound up being a huge talking point of the episode that we didn't really address. Though you, Richard, after we stopped recording last week, were like, why would Sam need a bank loan? so we should have talked about this last week. I think, even if Tony hadn't set it up, honestly, if Sam had only to send Pepper Potts one email, and I'm pretty sure he would have been set up and fine. But maybe he has his reasons that he doesn't want to. But the other question is, this work he's doing for the military, both for and sort of off the books of the military, surely he's getting paid and well for that, right? Like the episode one opens with him doing this like daring rescue. Where is his major compensation for that? So I don't have a great answer for this. I honestly think they wanted to just do this scenario, which was a really pointed, good, well done scene. But I think the logic around it is falling apart for some people. So I don't have a good answer for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in as much as the show thus far has been looking at the function of race in America, particularly for someone who has, you know, given so much of himself to a country that then turns around and, you know, disregards or worse, you know, things that he needs. Maybe Sam was being paid less than his white counterparts, which is certainly a reality for people in this country and elsewhere. So, maybe that will come to bear later. I don't know. I also think that, like, in addition to that, not separate of, but like, I could see a sort of government or whatever that was so caught up in like all of these pressing things that no one ever got around to, you know, like it just sort of happened, which would be another thing, like kind of exploiting free labor. But yeah, I do think that had the email to Pepper Potts gone out, and Tony Stark definitely would have been like just subject line only kind of guy, you know, like an old boss I had, like nothing in the body text, just terse, money for them, you know.
Yeah, and just like a dash TS or whatever.
All right, there's a third component to Paul's email.
Hit me.
The question, it's a good question. 3, are Bucky and Sam going to kiss in the series? I ask mainly in jest, but would love for Marvel to have a gay power couple, and I ship it. Obviously, I've been banging this drum for a while. I wrote a snippet of a fake screenplay for this show that went, I tweeted out and got, I don't know, mini viral, I guess. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think so. Not these two. They're certainly playing with that a little bit. I thought there was a moment in this second episode that was a bit gay panicky, maybe for my liking, when they're in that sort of joint therapy session. And had to like dare, oh god, touch knees or whatever.
And you're too close. You know, you're a little close. You're a little close.
Their knees, and I was like, all right, vaguely in the vicinity of their crotches, and you know, and it's like, well, you guys wear these tight suits. Like, what do you expect? You know,
boots are so red and shiny. The one thing I will say, I'm not defending any gay panic ever, obviously, but the one thing I like to try to remind myself from time to time is that Bucky is like defrosted from the 1940s. So, and then like dropped in Wakanda for a while, so like, not to say that Wakanda isn't gay friendly, I have no idea, but just sort of like he hasn't gotten any chance to hang out in modern America yet, so I'm not defending his reaction. I didn't like that moment. I was like, this is unnecessary. But I liked the they're literally in couples counseling, and I did like that aspect of it, you know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah. But we'll see. Who knows? You know, Marvel, I guess, could throw a real curveball or curve shield. All right. Jonathan writes to us about Wyatt Russell. He says, Wyatt Russell as Captain America looked like Timothy Oliphant in Boba Fett's armor. It just seemed wrong. I know Wyatt Russell from the AMC show Lodge 49. In that show, he plays an aimless surfer bro. I really hope he brings a comedy vibe to this character. Like White Vision, I hope there are fan nicknames for his character, like, I think, Fagin? And then, I don't know what that's a reference to, and then Faptin America, which, if his name was Faptin America, that would imply...
That's something else entirely.
Something different. but yeah, I mean, I think that's a, you know, I think Wyatt Russell is an interesting choice for this role of a, perhaps naive, perhaps sinister, perhaps both, sort of, you know, chiseled figure for this kind of thing, because he has, you know, he's the son of Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell. I think he grew up in Colorado with the other Russell Hudson kids, like kind of surfer bum or ski bum kind of guy. And he's played that kind of role in other, you know, film and TV. So this is an interesting kind of shift for him. Mm-hmm. But yeah, maybe they're going to tease out more of that aspect of him as the series goes. But I kind of don't see that happening the way they're framing the character so far.
What was that Linklater college baseball boy movie?
Everybody Wants Some.
Yeah, that's my favorite Wyatt Russell stoner role is in that one. Yeah, I think a lot of people pointed out that like they think he has a really punchable face, which is like quite a thing to say. I mean, I think that's mostly had to do like in the helmet. The helmet was just not flattering Wyatt Russell's face. I feel like when we see him with the helmet off in this, he cuts like a much more dashing figure. But something that I think is going to be I have a lot of questions about this episode, and one of them has to do with continuity. The continuity felt a little weird and sloppy to me, which is feels below the standard of a Marvel movie. And one of the continuity things that I was watching was Wyatt Russell's beard, which kind of his like stubble, his scruff kind of comes and goes. And maybe that's intentional. I'm on Wyatt Russell beard watch 2021 is my point. And I'm not talking about John Walker's wife. And then, the other thing I was going to say about the question. Oh, Fagin is from that's a Game of Thrones thing. It's a Song of Ice and Fire thing. Fake Aegon, Fagin. I solicit all candidates for a fake Captain America, but I reject Captain America.
keep it on fucking Reddit or something. I don't know. we don't want fap talk here.
All right. So that's it for emails, unless you have anything else you want to say about that.
Well, actually, I did have a question that I think could lead us into a bigger discussion of the episode.
Okay. Well, let me really quickly do one quick shout out. We got an email from Tottenville High School in Staten Island, New York, from Mark Montalbano and Stephanie Schwall, who teach four periods of English for seniors, and they used our WandaVision podcast as part of their unit last month. And I don't know if they're doing it with Falcon Winter Soldier, but I just want to say hello to those students and those teachers that they're listening, and I just think it's so cool. And a little daunting that we might be used in a school. So
thinking back to some stuff I might have said on the WandaVision podcast that I wouldn't have willingly said to teens. But yeah, that's really cool. Thank you for listening and treating it with the importance it does not deserve.
So go Pirates. All right. What's your question,
Rachel? All right. So Molly writes to us and says, this weekend I was watching Captain America, the First Avenger with my family. Mm-hmm. And in the fight scene on the plane between Red Skull and Cap, Red Skull says, "You could have the power of the gods, yet you wear a flag on your chest and think you fight a battle of nations. I have seen the future, Captain, and there are no flags." Do you think this is connected to the Flag Smashers at all? Maybe they're tied to Hydra's bigger ideals. I think that's a great question, because we're now sort of localizing in this episode the Flag Smashers personally. Like, we've met actual people with names and seen someone like die for the cause. So I think we're going to have to get to know more of what they stand for, because, I have to say, I did see some criticism of the first episode online along, a similar sort of like, this is militaristic propaganda, kind of questioning whether the stated mission of the Flag Smashers of a global nation, no borders kind of thing. Like, how bad is that actually? So I think that to my mind, from this episode, it seems we could be arriving at a situation like in Black Panther, where the villain is kind of right about a lot.
Yeah.
And then the Marvel just kind of makes the judgment that, yes, they might be right about such and such issue. I think that, Killmonger is right about a lot more than so far the Flag Smashers seem to be, but they just make the judgment like, yes, but they're not doing it right, and that's why we have to kind of smack it down.
That's sort of something that Malcolm Spellman, the head writer, said on the podcast last week. Don't worry, Richard, I don't expect you to listen to the interview segment at all. You have a lot of things to do. But like he said they printed out Killmonger's speech and like put it up in their writer's room as inspiration for like the whole idea of Killmonger was right. Felt like the ethos that they wanted for this show, which is like all of their antagonists, whether you count John Walker, the new Captain America, among them, will not be mustache twirling villains. They will all have a point of view that will feel valid from some angles. And then once again, as you say, it's the methods that we need to question more than the ideology. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, my memory is so spotty these days. Have we really seen the Flag Smashers like kill a lot of people?
No, they've just been
just stolen things.
They've been beating people up.
not good, ideally, but like
our heroes do that all the time.
Yeah,
so,
exactly. Like sometimes you have to. I don't know. I just, the whole thing with them trying to get vaccines to people, that obviously felt very pertinent to right now.
Yeah. This idea that some people are calling them Robin Hood, stuff like that.
Anti-police, I think with all the stuff happening in Echo Park in Los Angeles right now, like, you know, this all sort of does have that timber of the Killmonger ethos where you're like, yeah, but they're saying stuff that, you know, should be more universally believed to be true.
Well, I think similarly with this new Captain America, and that segues into something that I want to talk about, but like, I think some people expected when he showed up at the end of last week's episode that like we would meet him and he would just be the worst. Like, I think they're primed for, someone like Homelander from The Boys, you know what I mean? To like get something like that. If you watch that show, that's a character that is clear perversion on the Captain America ideology. He is the like the disgusting villain of that show with his like blonde hair and chiseled jaw and good looks. And it's a really fun, like, I love what The Boys does with that, but like, that's not what this show is doing so far, at least with this John Walker character. We meet him in a really sympathetic place in this like opening locker room scene, right? Where he's just like wants to do right by this honor that he's been given. And I think that's such a more interesting story than if he were a complete monstrous jerk. He might still be revealed to be, but I actually don't think so based on sort of this idea of like, we're not doing out and out villains this season. We're doing, okay, I see what you were going for. You didn't do it the way that I wish you had done it, you know, sort of thing. So,
yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
And I think that the way in this episode they set up his kind of cocky mediocrity, you know, as opposed to Sam's less cocky competence. And there's certainly a statement on race in there where, like, absolutely, you know, this white guy has to work half as hard and has a quarter of the ability and gets the big thing, you know, and is sort of more, is like readily accepted as that hero, whereas Sam is not, you know, and he's being denied bank loans. That seems a stringent commentary. I think the question is whether the new Captain America's role in that is just like passively complicit or actively, you know, either way, it's not good, but
I think they very pointedly, so we meet John Walker, you know, for real in this episode. We meet his wife, Olivia, and his best friend, Lamar Hoskins, who, you know, adopts the moniker Battlestar. And I think it's, you know, very pointed that both his wife and his best friends are not white people. I think that's, you know, I'm not saying you can't be racist and have like black friends, but I'm saying I think they, you know, do that intentionally so we're not immediately in a position of like, ah, white supremacist John Walker. Do you know what I mean? Like, they're trying to complicate it a bit. So let's zoom out a little bit from that, but we're going to come back to John Walker. And I just want to ask you, Richard, like, what do you think? Small question. What do you think makes a good Captain America? Like, what makes a man Captain America?
You know, like 6'2", can cook. I think the problem with a character like that, it's kind of similar to Superman, is that ideally they have to be so noble and is that interesting storytelling, you know? But in the text of Marvel, like the figure of Captain America has to be selfless and caring and brave and all this stuff, but also comfortable working in the service at times of like imperialism and all that stuff. And so can there be a good person who fills that role? You know, we were talking last week about Sam, you know, understanding the call to duty, but also understanding its corrupting influence. And, you know, Steve Rogers was such an outlier because he didn't really belong in the time that he ended up being in, you know, for most of his run as Captain America. Sure, he was also Captain America in the 40s. But, you know, I think maybe the question is not who is the right Captain America, but if there is one. You know, because this is a hero that was selected and made versus many of the other characters in this series who just sort of happen to have these things happen to them because it was an accident or they were born in space that way or whatever, you know? And so I think it's questioning the idea, and the Captain America movies have done this, and the series seems to be doing that to some extent, of like, is a kind of super soldier constructed deliberately by a very rich, aggressive government actually ever a good idea? You know, is mm-hmm. there any nobility to be extracted from it in the long run?
Yeah, so it's interesting because, like, John Walker, as he says in this episode, he doesn't have the fanciest gadgets. He has not had any super soldier serum. He has not had
not even
super
in college
strength. Not just as an experiment once. And so I was rewatching the first Avenger, the first Captain America movie, and there's just a lot of discussion in that film about like why the character of Erskine, played by Stanley Tucci, thinks Steve is the right man for the job versus there's this other bigger, brawnier, more obviously, you know, like blonde, square jawed man in his company that's who Tommy Lee Jones wants to be Captain America, right? But Stanley Tucci's like, no, it's Steve. And he says, Tommy Lee Jones says, you don't win wars with niceness, doctor. You win wars with guts. And that's when he throws the grenade in that famous scene where Steve hops on the grenade, right? And I just thought it was interesting in this episode when John's giving his Good Morning America interview. He says, I've got guts. You know what I mean? Which is the like Tommy Lee Jones sort of definition of who Captain America should be. And like in that moment, Steve reveals himself to be the one who has guts in that moment. But I think if you asked Erskine who, like, what does Captain America need, it's more about heart than it is guts, if that makes any sense. And like, we're not talking about the super soldier serum as it pertains to John Walker, at least not yet. But there's this, one of my favorite scenes in all of the Marvel universe is before the night before before Steve gets injected like a butterball turkey and plumped up into his Captain America shape. He has this conversation with Erskine where Erskine talks to him about like what the super soldier serum does, which is it just enhances what is already there. If you are strong, it'll make you stronger. If you know, like whatever. And if you've got something bad in you, as like, I'm sorry, bad is very judgmental, but as Hugo Weaving's character Red Skull does, it will enhance that as well. And so Erskine's like, you have to be the best man in order to be able to come through this and come out the other side. And when he's talking about Red Skull, he says, it's not that the serum wasn't ready, it's that the man wasn't ready. Like, the serum wasn't ready, but most importantly, the man, meaning Red Skull. And he's like, you, Steve, I think you're ready. And Erskine's proven correct over several films in the MCU. But the question is, like, is John Walker, even though he's not getting the super soldier serum, is that man ready for this title and all the pressures that come with it? I think that's the question we're going to be zeroing in on, you know?
And if he was selected by, you know, some government cabal or whatever, like, is there any way that he could, could be ultimately good, you know, like, because there are clearly cynical aims at play. I mean, I don't think you ever see scenes in movies where the hero is being trotted out and kissing babies and signing things, and, you know, and then that's supposed to be like, yeah, and this is good. Don't question this, you know. Clearly there's some, you know, text there.
Yeah, we should say, I mean, like, that's what Captain America was originally, you know, created for in that first Avenger movie, right? There's that whole montage of Steve going around selling war bonds at, like, USO shows, essentially, right? And there's this, I wanted to bring this up, actually. There's a song in that film called Star Spangled Man, which is the name of this episode of television. And Lamar Hoskins, John's friend, you know, says Star Spangled Man and all that. And that song was written by, Alan Menken and, I had the lyricist written down somewhere. I'll find it. But David Zappel, who did City of Angels, which I think is a really underrated musical, by the way. It's an Alan Menken, David Zappel song that they sort of remixed for this opening with the band in the high school football field. And that's one of the moments of the episode that I really loved. It plays over the opening Marvel screen, and it's this Star Spangled Man song, but like updated. And I think a lot of people who love Steve Rogers as Captain America felt sort of sick to their stomach to hear this song identified with him, identified with this new guy who they don't trust. But I thought that was a really fun and interesting moment in the episode, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But the last thing I will say about like who deserves to be Captain America, if you think about Steve Rogers, who was like this, you know, 90-pound weakling young man in the 40s, underestimated. Like that's what you could say most about Steve, underestimated. And I think you can apply that to Sam. He's not physically on the back foot here. He's very strong, very capable, stuff like that. But because of his position in modern America, he's underestimated. And in many ways, in ways that John Walker could never have experienced. And does that then make him actually the ideal Erskine-approved candidate for being Captain America, you know?
Right. Right. Because how can someone be a true champion if they are working, again, either passively complicit or actively in that kind of white supremacy, I don't think that the show is setting, like you said, I don't know that they're setting up John to be like a white supremacist figure the way that like Homelander is, yeah. Maybe I don't know. I think also, to talk about this stuff, to go further into the episode, like we meet this character Isaiah,
yeah,
who was a contemporary of Bucky's in the 50s, like during the mm-hmm. Korean War, and mm-hmm. had super serum, so he basically mm-hmm. was given all of the things that these other heroes were, and yet, much to Sam's consternation and frustration, is like, wait, but how come we don't know about this guy?
Mm-hmm.
And I think mm-hmm. that's definitely factoring into this sort of the racial dialogue that's happening in this show, which especially because it's immediately followed by this very tense and symbolic scene with the police.
Absolutely. And I think that police scene on the heels of the bank loan scene, is just more of the great work that this show is doing to bring that conversation into a superhero context of like a scenario that we have become like upsettingly familiar with in America. And it's like something that Malcolm Spellman said is like, if you think about Sam in the context of like, a football star, right? That there's just like no level, you could be president of the United States, Barack Obama, and there's no level of power that you can achieve that will shield you from these kinds of, racial indignities. So there's this moment where, the white cop is told like basically, that's an Avenger, that's Sam Wilson, and that's like saying like that's a quarterback for this team, and like, oh, sorry, I didn't recognize you, sir, like sort of thing. And it's just sort of it's chilling. But yeah, I do want to talk about Isaiah Bradley. How'd you feel about that scene? We've got Carl Lumley, my one of my favorite actors from Alias, is here to play Isaiah Bradley, who in the comics is actually the first Captain America before Steve Rogers. But here he's been sort of shifted over to the Korean War. What were your reactions to the scene?
Well, I like any time in this kind of, storytelling where you get a sort of sudden reveal of like deeper history that even characters in the show didn't know, mm-hmm. Because of course there would be other people. They weren't just going to give it to like one guy in 1940, whatever, and then be like, well, and we're done, and clearly there's a tie to be like, okay, if there was super serum in the past that we didn't know about, obviously these new flag smasher people like have some access to it too. So there's mm-hmm. a continuity there. But yeah, I think that we've seen stuff like Watchmen, of late that have taken the framework and the kind of storytelling traditions of superhero stories and not grafted them onto the context of like America's history, but actually inserted them where they probably would have been. You know, it's a what if, sure, because it's all made up, but it feels like it's less about trying to apply history to superhero stories, but instead applying superhero stories to history. And you think about the Tuskegee experiment, and you know, there's a film called I believe it's called The Walking Dead about black soldiers in Vietnam who are totally, you know, thrown to the wolves in the war, after the war. You know, it's I think Dead Presidents is a movie about that too. You know, I think that teasing out that aspect of America's real history in a story like this, in a strange way, even though there are shields flying around and people jumping 30 feet in the air, it lends it more credibility and thus makes it that much more resonant.
Yeah. Anthony and I talked about this a little bit at the tail end of last week's episode, because Malcolm Spellman recommended the comic Red, White, and Black, Truth, Red, White, and Black, which is the story of Isaiah Bradley. And it's sort of this thing that's revealed that before they put the quote unquote perfected serum in Steve Rogers, they experimented on hundreds of black soldiers. It's meant to be to invoke directly the Tuskegee experiments, and to send several chills up and down your spine and make you feel disgusted. In the comics, Isaiah Bradley is the first Captain America. In this context, like I said, this is a Korean War scenario. I think because actor Carl Lumley is 69 years old, is not as old, I just want to say, as what we're presented with in that scene. And I always get suspicious. Whenever that happens, I feel like we're going to get a flashback. So I suspect we will get, I don't know if we'll be lucky enough to get a whole episode. I think it'd be really cool if they did that. But get at least some of an episode dedicated to the full Isaiah Bradley story.
Which would be, let's generously say, an echo of a standalone episode in Watchmen.
Yes. But one of the best episodes of television. So if you're gonna echo the best, you know, why not do it? It would be interesting to see like Bucky in that context. And then something, you know, something that Anthony and I talked about last week, but is fun to point out, is that Eli Bradley, who is Isaiah's grandson, who opened the door for Sam and Bucky. That character is a superhero in his own right in the comics, known as Patriot, and part of the Young Avengers team. We talked about the Young Avengers a little bit when we were talking about Wanda's twin boys in WandaVision. And it just really feels like they've got their foot on the gas trying to build up the Young Avengers across these various TV shows. So he's played by an actor named Elijah Richardson, who has not done much so far. And so this is like a real potential for, like, you know, you might have just seen the introduction of a new star of Marvel content. He's a leader of the Young Avengers. So we'll see if that turns out for him. But
And having a character named Patriot be a young black man at a time when that word patriot, I mean, it's been co-opted for a long time, but like especially recently has been seized by the white nationalist right, you know, all the way up to like Ivanka Trump on the day of the Capitol siege, tweeting out like some patriots, you know, whatever, like it's become a very loaded word. So I think a kind of almost reclamation of that word would be interesting to see down the line.
We met Patriot. I completely agree with you. We should say that in the comics, John Walker also goes by the name U.S. Agent rather than Captain America. He also goes by Captain America at one point. So like if we wind up with Captain America, like let's say Sam becomes Captain America. We don't know for certain, but let's say he does. He's Captain America. John Walker, if he sticks around, which he may not, U.S. agent, and then we have Patriot in the form of Eli, which is just, it's an interesting little triumvirate they're building there. And then we have Battlestar, who we meet, Lamar Hoskins, played by Clay Bennett. I got really interested in this Lamar figure. I thought Clay Bennett like was made a really striking entrance into the series, and I don't know how much more we'll learn about him in this, but I would like to. All right. So, I mean, that's mostly what I want to talk about in terms of like Isaiah Bradley and John Walker and what makes Captain America, because those are like sort of the two questions hanging around those men. I guess I'll lastly say really quickly that like something that Marvel is struggling with as time goes on is these like wartime origin stories for these various characters. Like, it works to put Steve and Bucky on ice so they could still maintain their original comic book origin story, which is World War II. And World War II is such a perfect origin point for Steve Rogers, because that's like one of our most uncomplicated wars that America was involved with, because like Hitler is still like a figure that we can just uncomplicatedly say, yep. And they bomb Pearl Harbor. Yep. This, we're involved, and there's a bad guy, and there's no question about the badness here, right? And every war after that gets more complicated. And I think it's interesting that John Walker's character in the comic books, his origin is tied more closely to the Vietnam War, a much more morally murky war that, it was his brother who was a soldier in the Vietnam War, and that's what inspired him to serve. But like, you know, I just think that that's interesting. And the fact that it's the Korean War for Isaiah Bradley is interesting, because that's a war that we like almost forget to talk about. Like, mm-hmm. Right? We don't talk about the Korean War. And, you know, so to make this forgotten Captain America figure part of this forgotten war, at least in terms of the way that American history is taught, I think is an interesting choice.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Korean War is so forgotten that people think MASH is about the Vietnam War. And veterans of the Korean War are in the quote-unquote silent generation, you know. I think going into that, Kevin's dad on Wonder Years is a Korean War vet.
Oh,
that was my like first like introduction to that war, I guess. But yeah, I think you're right. You know, I think there also in terms of like the World War II aspect of Steve Rogers, like it is telling in some ways that all the sort of Hydra stuff and Red Skull and all that, it's clearly Nazi stuff.
Yeah.
And they kind of don't, at least from my memory, don't go into the Japanese theater of the war,
no.
Partly because that ends with like the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which, you know, are like war crimes essentially that the US did in a, you know, so it's like,
yeah.
I think that, you know, again, I do have reservations about watching a whole series or about the sort of military aspect of this whole thing, because I think it has been used a bit jingoistically, let's say, in Marvel films past. But if they're kind of bringing up all of these ghosts or you know, tossed aside people from the past to kind of have this broader reckoning with like what the ethos and the people even that created Captain America were doing all along throughout this century, that could be a sort of interesting unearthing of like a new meaning of the Avengers, which then, you know, in Marvel synergy would pave way for like young Avengers, you know, to kind of correct the wrongs of the past.
Yeah. I have questions about, you know, that I, you know, I will try to dig into about, you know, Captain Marvel was a film where, the collaboration with the US Air Force, was something that people had a lot of questions about. And in this episode, we see the John Walker posters that are sort of around the hangar where Sam and Bucky and Danny take off, have like an official U.S. Army logo on them. So like you, and that has to be cleared, right, in order to be used. So that implies some sort of collaboration. So I don't know. We'll keep an eye on sort of what's going to happen here in terms of interrogating American military might. And yes, when I said World War II was our most morally uncomplicated war, that of course does not include this horrific thing we did. And also the most uncomplicated American war is still incredibly complicated. So yes. All right. Let's talk about a few other things that get mentioned before we go. Yeah.
Can I just, I just want to say, you know, my father was American historian. And so I have a little perspective on this, but like the most uncomplicated American war thus far has been the war with Grandpa. And that was very, very complicated.
All right. At one point, Bucky or Sam says, "The last time we stole this shield, do you remember? How well do you remember the events of Captain America: Civil War, Richard?"
I remember there was an airport thing, right?
Yes. At one point, the government, as represented, as it always should be by William Hurt, takes possession of the Black Panther suit, the Falcon wings, and the shield. And, Sharon Carter, as played by Emily Van Camp, sort of helps the heroes steal their stuff back a little bit, like passively kind of, and gets in a lot of trouble for it. So, we learn that she was, you know, an enemy of the state because of her involvement in that. And, or not passively, actually, I think she has it in the trunk of her car. So actively Sharon Carter boosted the shield, for them. So, we know that Sharon Carter's in the show. We haven't seen her yet, but that's just like, you know, they dropped her name as a mention here to get us ready for, you know, maybe we'll meet her next week, something like that. So Sharon Carter, she's done stuff for heroes in the past. Will she do stuff with the heroes in the future? Time will tell.
Or will she want revenge? Because Emily Van Camp was on Revenge.
She sure was. I hope she shows up in a gown. All right. And then Baron Zemo. What do you remember about Zemo, Richard?
That's Daniel Brühl's character?
Yes.
Correct. I do remember when I reviewed that movie that I liked that the villain was sort of not concerned with world domination, but actually looking at the heroes themselves. And, you know, like his beef was with them, you know, not with the world. It kind of felt like, am I remembering wrong?
Yeah, no, you're right.
So I think that's interesting. Yeah. He felt like the first villain who was truly reactive to what we'd seen previous, you know?
Yeah, so he basically, in the end of the film Avengers: Age of Ultron, the Avengers, in order to try to stop Ultron, which is a monster, you know, that Tony Stark unleashed in the first place, like basically destroy Sokovia. And that's why we get the whole like thing, the whole thing in Civil War is a thing called the Sokovia Accords, which is like there to put a check on the power of these superheroes. And Baron Zemo is a man who lost his entire family in the wreckage of that Sokovian disaster. And so his mission in Civil War is to, from behind the scenes, manipulate the Avengers to that airport fight that you referenced, like get them in a position where they're fighting each other. Cause he sees them as he wants, you know, revenge. And, you know, Emily Van Camp style, for what happened to his family. And I love Zemo as an antagonist in that way. He's one of the smarter antagonists we get in the way that he manipulates these very smart people, into like, you know, fighting themselves. So yeah. Baron Zemo, he's in Zell 2187 awaiting Sam and Bucky. I laughed out loud when there was just randomly an insert shot of a chessboard. I don't know what that choice was. I thought it was very silly. But otherwise I'm very excited for Zemo to show up, but I thought it was really like a little too Magneto for them to be like, here he is. He's in jail. Also, the chess game begins.
Yes.
You know, it's like, okay. I would like a supervillain in jail to play, I don't know, backgammon, something else.
Uno.
anything else you want to say about this episode before we wrap up?
R.I.P. Red Wing, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Snapped in half by a lady from the other group. No, I think that's it. I think we covered a lot. I will be curious to hear what you and Anthony have to say about it. I will listen, I promise, because I think with this show versus WandaVision, it actually helps to get more of that context that I don't have. So yeah, until next week.
All right, until next week. I will. Where will you be, Richard? Until next week.
Well, I mean, for some reason they asked me to fix this Red Wing thing, so I gotta like get like robot fixing for dummies or something. And I'm like I'm on deadline for a magazine piece, and I don't have time, but. What can you do? Duty calls. I also will be at Ryla's on Twitter and reviewing and other things at vf.com.
All right. I will definitely not be sacrificing myself so my gang can get away in a moment that really buys them zero time whatsoever and just involves me throwing my body in front of guns. I will also be on Vanity Fair, and I will see those of you who are sticking around for the back half with Anthony Breskin.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jessie Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
All right, we are in the back half. We are in the real nerd stuff now, Anthony Breznican. So my question for you is, do you want to start with something really nerdy, or do you want to start with me asking you the big question that I also asked Richard?
Well, let's start with the big question.
All right. Anthony Breznican, what yes. in your mind makes a good Captain America?
Oh, good question. That's the key question. You're right. This is a big one. It's a heavy lift. I'm stalling.
Okay, do you want to talk about...
No. Yeah, I'm just kidding. No, I think it is... It's the soul, right? It's the heart of the character. It doesn't matter so much. Well, he's got to be strong, too. You know, he's got to be able to take a punch or a blast or fall out of a plane, whatever he needs to do, to be interesting. But what makes him... not just a muscle man, some sort of like tough guy villain. We've seen plenty of those. There are plenty of tough guys out there mm-hmm. in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Crossbones, for instance.
Mm.
But what makes...
A Romulo reference.
Yeah.
This early in the morning. Very delightful. Early, right?
But it's like, what makes Steve Rogers into Captain America and what makes him inspiring is that spirit, right? That he's a mm-hmm. little guy inside, and he knows what it's like to not be strong. I think mm-hmm. that's the key to Captain America, to knowing what it's like to not be strong.
That's something. So I talked to Richard.
Survey says.
I think that's a really good answer. I talked to Richard a lot about. You know, I was rewatching the first Captain America movie, which was your recommendation. I will give you all the cookies for that. But I was rewatching it this last week and really zeroing in on what. Stanley Tucci's character Erskine says about like why he chose Steve. Why Steve?
Yes.
You know, because the question we're asking is like, why John Walker? Why Sam Wilson? Why Isaiah Bradley? Why Bucky Barnes? Like, why all these candidates? Who would make the best by the Erskine method, I suppose? And
what does he say? Maybe he should try the little guy.
Oh, a beautiful Stanley Tucci impression. Love it. No, but he says, you know, it's that thing about not knowing what it's like to not feel strong.
Yeah.
Is something that Erskine says, basically, like, you know, a man who's been strong his whole life, like, he will never he won't be able to handle the strength. But a man who hasn't known strength. Mm-hmm. And I actually don't know that that's always the case. Honestly, I find that sometimes people who have been like bullied their own lives become the biggest bullies.
That's true.
Once they gain some power. But let's just say we live in Erskine's world and he's right about this.
Oh, okay. Then I'm going to, you know what? Can I amend my answer?
Yeah. Yes.
You're right. You're absolutely right about that. Is that some of the meanest people are those who've suffered, you know, and they're going to dole that out to other people. This is a subject that's really, you know, dear to me. It's something I've seen. I've been interested in how human beings work, like why some abused kids grow up to be even worse abusers than their parents. Mm. You know, why some kids who were bullied grow up to be really horrible bullies. And I think the answer to your question is, what do we need in Captain America? Empathy.
No matter
what his size, whether he's the little guy, see little guy or the big guy, I think Captain America has to have empathy.
She's a little guy. Wow, I love that. Yeah, and so something that I was sort of workshopping with Richard and I want to run by you is this idea that, like, Sam Wilson's obviously not a little guy, right? He's a big, strong man.
Yeah.
But the way in which this show is really underscoring all of the ways in which the deck is stacked against him as mm-hmm. a black man in America, does that put him in that position, give him that understanding of what it's like to not be defenseless, but not be as, you know, to have the odds against you, I suppose, the same way Steve did.
Yeah, I think in a way, for sure. Yeah. And you could say, well, a lot of people go through that experience, and that's true, but a lot of people also go through the experience of being bullied or overlooked or mistreated. You know, I think it's similar, yeah, similar mindset of, I know what it's like to be prejudged and to be mistreated and considered unnecessary by society.
Yeah, and considered not the right man for the job. Like, if you think about Steve...
Oh, right, yeah.
You know, Steve being... The way that First Avenger opens, Steve is, like, rejected again and again for a military service, despite wanting to serve, right? And so, like, if we have this storyline here where Sam, less directly, but still has been rejected from this job of Captain America... I just think that that's an interesting parallel because, like, I don't think of Sam Wilson and Steve Rogers as, like, you know, strong personality matches. And I don't think either of them would say they were, you know, something like that. So I was just trying to find, like, what is the core of Sam that makes him the man for the job? You know, obviously he's, like, strong and brave and a good hero and all that sort of stuff like that. But according to the Marvel Universe, that's not the question we should be asking when we ask what makes a good Captain America.
Yeah, and I'd sound a little note of caution. Like, we're not saying, I don't think you're saying, I'm certainly not saying that being a, you know, black in America is akin to being a little white guy, right? Like, that's
not at all.
Different experiences. And I think it's more about people who have very different experiences can still end up with similar personality qualities, which is I think you learn what it's like to hurt and you do not want to hurt other people. And conversely, there's that phrase, hurt people, right? And that's what you were talking about earlier, is that sometimes people were mistreated.
Sometimes.
Pass that on to others. I think I just think among these two individual characters, a quality they share is empathy. Because what is Sam doing when Steve Rogers meets him for the first time in the Winter Soldier? They're running, right? But also, what's he doing in his professional life is he's helping counseling other soldiers who have PTSD. So he's like, even if he's not fighting, Sam is doing the work of a good guy.
That helps us understand why he was so ready for therapy in this episode. He's like, oh, I know therapy. Yes, yeah, I'm ready. Right. I'm conversant. Okay. That's exactly what I want to talk about. And so then in the case of John Walker, who we meet not as like an awful villain of this episode, right? There are moments of a lot of sympathy and empathy for John Walker in this episode. But as a man who has been given a title and feels a lot of pressure around it, and maybe he has the wrong idea of who Captain America should be, but his idea of who Captain America should be is not necessarily like a bad idea. Like, I would give him a B, but I wouldn't give him an F. What do you think?
Yes. A little lower than a B. I mean, I think it's interesting that the show starts off by putting us in John Walker's shoes. Like, it's not... I think it gave us a moment to recoil from him at the end of the first episode.
Right.
And then this one, you begin, you know, it breaks the perspective and shifts over to John Walker from, you know, from Bucky and from Sam. And we see, you know, he's worried and he's trying, and that he's not just some like, ha ha, now the bad guy gets to be Captain America. Like, he's really trying to do what he thinks is right. I think the problem is he doesn't understand what's right necessarily.
Correct.
He hasn't he hasn't paid his dues in the empathy.
He's the wrong man for the job.
In his empathy journey, you know?
Right.
And he has, you know, we meet his friend. I guess this was, you mentioned, like, what are we going to, let's dive into the geeky stuff. Like, how many people watch this show and, like, a character appears who has a name tag and then instantly, like, Google that? Like, and, you know, we meet his friend, and before we get an introduction to his buddy, who only has the name tag Hoskins. Mm-hmm. Ooh, Hoskins, I know that. I've heard that before. That's mm-hmm. and then later, you know, he says his first name is Lamar. And by that point, I think all of the Google junkies out there have figured out that this is Battlestar, another character from Marvel Comics, of course. But, you know, interesting relationship. They're soldiers, they're friends. They both believe in doing what's right. You can clearly see that, you know, that Lamar Hoskins is a black man, so he must be coming from a similar background where he's experienced something at least similar to what we were just talking about. And so, you know, they're coming at it from a similar, or they're going, they have similar aspirations, but I think there's just something about the two of them that's a little different from Sam and Steve, right? What did you think?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And like, it's interesting because, well, fun fact about Battlestar that I thought I'd share with you is that, so originally, Battlestar is associated with U.S. Agent, who's John Walker in the comics, right? He's like, U.S. Agent shows up and has rolls with a gang, kind of, called the Bold Urban Commandos. And they're
the
Buckies, right? B-U-C Buckies.
I doubt that's coincidence, right?
Right, right. However, and so they were going to name him Buck or Bucky, you know, as he became a Battlestar, or as he became a superhero. And apparently, Mark Gruenwald, who wrote, you know, the John Walker stuff, we mentioned him before we were talking about comics to read. He got enough mail from black fans writing in saying that the term That's Buck right. or Bucky had like a negative racial association. It does, like the idea of a buck as a black man is, and so they were like, yep, okay, and just changed it to Battlestar. They were like, throw that all the way out the window into the trash. Thank you for that. So named him Battlestar instead. So I just thought that was a little bit of interesting comic book lore. Yeah, but basically Battlestar and U.S. Agent John Walker, Lamar Hoskins, show up with superpowers, and that is exactly what I want to talk to you about here. They get it from a character named the Power Broker. The Power Broker gets name dropped in this episode as someone that maybe the Flag Smasher stole some super soldier serum from. So I have a theory.
All right, what's your
theory? Are you ready?
Okay. Theory time.
So some people think that maybe the super soldier serum that the Flag Smashers sold and juiced themselves up with, which is why they're able to punch and so good and run so fast. It was meant for John and Lamar, and they stole what belonged to them. And so some people are like, oh, that text message, like, you took what was mine, I'm going to come after you, is from John. I don't think that's the case. But what I do worry about, we meet John Walker, a kind of mostly okay man who has some bad ideas about who should be Captain America, and mostly, most of all, a man who feels a lot of pressure to live up to this Captain America thing. And he mentions specifically that he doesn't have super strength like Steve did. So my worry is that John, feeling the pressure and not feeling like he's being a good enough Captain America, strong enough, mistakenly thinks that he needs super soldier serum, like that's all he needs to like be as good as Steve Rogers was. And so maybe he will try to contact this Power Broker figure from the comic books and get juiced up with super soldier serum, both John and Lamar. And that will go very wrong, because as Erskine says in the first Avenger, like, the super soldier serum just enhances what is already there. And if there's a problem there, it will only enhance that.
Exacerbate it. Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You know, and another element from the comic book lore that is worth mentioning is that, you know, the title, what's the title of this episode? The Star Spangled Man?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Which, of course, is the song from the Captain America. Captain America, the First Avenger, when he's like, when he's on the USO tour, right? When he's, you war know, bonding. Punching out Hitler and selling war bonds and dancing with the chorus. And they even play some of that song in, the marching band that introduces John Walker before his big interview with, in the middle of a stadium, which is a little strange, but, you know, there's a lot of song and dance and show there, and the Buckys, as they began in the comics, this team of like strong guys led by Battlestar were kind of a fake, right? They would stage attacks on U.S. Agent to, you know, make him look heroic.
Right.
So they were like, you know, this was all a publicity stunt and he wasn't really being attacked. And so this was sort of being drummed up to manipulate the public into supporting him and seeing him as their protector. You know, Battlestar, Lamar Hoskins was kind of, you know, the Washington Generals to John Walker's, the Harlem Globetrotters, you know, like you had the Harlem Globetrotters would show up and perform and you'd go to see them do their tricks, but they need opponents, right? So, you know, those opponents never win. It's all kind of a put on. It's
the
all,
heel. Yeah,
it's all perform. Yeah, it's the heel. Mm-hmm. It's all performative. And, I'm kind of wondering if we're going to see some element of that. Now, they clearly were working as a team in this episode, but it seems like so much of their activity is a front, right? Like they're strong for sure. But how much of this is real, you know? That's a question I have.
That's okay. You know, I think that's a fair question to ask yourself.
You know, and this whole notion of you can still be, you know, whatever, patriotic or, you know, trying to do good, and yet there's an aspect of fraud to what you're doing. I mean, Flags of Our Fathers was all about that, right? Is, you know, if this was a photograph and film footage taken that was taken after the flag was already raised and we just wanted to get better footage of it. And yet this is important for inspiring folks back home and the war effort. Like, well, that's not a bad thing. Inspiration isn't a bad thing. I think the question is just, are you being manipulated? And at what point does the potential to just be willing to manipulate people lead you into doing the wrong thing? Anyway,
I think the biggest flag, I mean, there's a few flags that we can throw on John Walker here. You know, like the wingman comment that sort of sets, that rightfully sort of sets Sam off. And then of course the like, stay out of my way comment, always that one last line, right? The stay out of my way thing, that's gonna make us feel, you know, more than uneasy. But for me, the biggest red flag, it comes in that early conversation between Lamar. And it's funny with John, these people always have like, their friends are always their friends they've known from childhood or whatever. So like John Walker's wife appears to have been his high school sweetheart. Mm-hmm. And his friend here says something like, this is why you flunked out of theater class. Like they went to school together at least before they were in the army together. So yeah. Like these are all, you know, he's got the trappings, the Steve Rogers trappings of like, you know, his longtime girl and his best friend and stuff like that. Right.
He doesn't get around much anymore. Like it's a very small world. Right.
Anyway. But, And, you know, we should say that John Walker in the comics has an older brother who was in the Vietnam War and who died in the Vietnam War. And he enlisted because he admired his brother. And so this idea of like admiration, trying to live up to the example of someone, I think like you could sort of slot Steve into that position. But here's the big red flag that I want to point out. When they're in the locker room before he goes out to his Good Morning America high school football field interview, Lamar says, you can't just punch your way out of problems anymore. Which to me is just indicative of there's some sort of violent past, you know, that doesn't really get underlined in this episode, sort of a throwaway line. But if that's something that's sort of lurking in the heart of John Walker. And if he did get himself some super soldier serum, would that not be then maybe enhanced in a way that will have disastrous consequences? So
yeah,
purely speculation, but just, you know, some thoughts and feelings about all of that.
That's a good catch. I mean, his overall level of disrespect, I think, was a red flag for me. You know, that he, yeah, you come in with good intentions, but here are the people who've been doing it for a while, and right. You're going to come in and be like, now I'm the boss. And, you know, I thought the way he, you know, it's great he bailed Bucky out. You know, oh, how about that cop scene? Jeez. We'll get mm-hmm. to that, I guess, once we get to the Bradleys. But, mm-hmm. you know, that was intense and upsetting. But he bails Bucky out, and no, that's nice, thanks. But, like, now he's going to, you know, have this weird swagger, this toxic nonsense where, you know, you're going to fall in line. It just reminds me yeah. of, like, everybody's vice principal, you know? And, you know, okay, so we don't have to do this if you don't want to, but I think we can get very personal about this on this particular show because the relationship there reminded me a little bit of you and me, Joanna.
Oh no. Okay.
Right? Okay.
Tell me. I'm ready.
All right.
Who am so, I? Like, which bully am us. I?
Oh no. Okay. So now we're going super uber geeky internally on our own selves. But like, you know, when I joined up with Vanity Fair, a year and a half ago, Joanna, what were people saying to you, who were like, oh, how do you feel about this guy joining
oh,
your team?
Oh, people were really worried that I was being usurped by you because our interests are so similar. And they were like, oh no, has Vanity Fair hired Anthony Brezikin in an attempt to toss Joanna out on her ear? What?
Yeah, basically. I mean, that would never have happened. But like, I just think like... Yeah, okay, you hire somebody else who has similar interests. It's like, oh, mm-hmm. do you feel like this person is going to move in on your turf, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think clearly people can tell we like each other and we we get along really mm-hmm. well. And we do this show 2 or 3 times a week when nobody's listening but us on the phone. And like, I think the reason for that is like just respect for each other. And like, I came in knowing like, I'm not here to chill. Here's like, hey, lady who covers Marvel, like, how would you like to see how it's done? Like, that's what I feel like John Walker is doing. Like, he's coming in and he's like, hey, yeah, you were Steve Rogers' pal, but, like, now I'm in charge and I got my own pal. Like, you know, meet Battlestar. We're taking over this town. And I just think, you know, in any dynamic where you have two people who have similar interests and goals, you have to have some level of respect or else that's going to go bad. And obviously you and I have that for each other. And that also comes from, I think, having empathy, which goes back to the original point, is that it's hard to have respect for someone if you don't have empathy for their situation or that they've been doing that same thing you're interested in for a long time and they deserve their space. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think John Walker could have gone a lot further if he had shown them the version of himself that we saw in the locker room.
Yes. Instead that vulnerability.
Of, yeah.
Versus
just
the, like bravado.
I know I'm not Steve,
mm-hmm.
but like, I want to, you know, I'm inspired by him and I think part of his power is passing that desire to do good on to others. And so mm-hmm. I'm trying to pick that up. I think it's similar to like when people have like a divorce in their family or a death in the family. And there's, you know, the mom or the dad has a new significant other. And, like, when that person comes in and tries to be the new dad, like, bad idea. When that person comes in and is like, I'm never going to replace, you know, your mom.
I don't even want to replace. I'm not trying to replace
them. I'm not trying to replace them. Yeah. And I think there's room and, you know.
Yeah. But I think.
Room for this relationship there that's separate from that. I just want to be your friend. Like, I think that goes a lot further. So I don't know. Maybe I'm going too far afield with this, but I think there's something.
No, I think you're right. But I think I think that John Walker's response is so human, which mm-hmm. is like, if he has some imposter syndrome going on, which how could he not if he's mm-hmm. taking on Steve Rogers' job, right? I think I do agree with you that the emotionally mature response would be to be like, hey, man, can you help me out? I know you know Steve better than I ever could. Like, mm-hmm. that's the most grating moment.
Yeah.
That's the most grating moment for Bucky, right? Is like him being like, yeah, I think of him as a brother. You know what I mean? I never met him, but he's like a brother to me. And Bucky's like, he's my actual brother. God damn it. You know,
I read The Hobbit in 1937 when it came out.
That's such a cute moment. That's been like teased in trailers, but one detail that I love about that is that Bucky wouldn't have read Lord of the Rings because that came out after he became an assassin. He can only make Hobbit references. He can't make Lord of the Rings references unless he read Lord of the Rings in Wakanda, which he might have.
But he says I read it in 1937 when it first came out, so he must be referencing.
No, right. He says The Hobbit. I'm just saying,
he says The Hobbit. Oh, okay, yeah.
He's like, I read The Hobbit in 1937 when it first came out, but I just like that it's a Hobbit reference and not, he can't be Lord of the Rings. Okay. Can I bring up, I think this is thematically related in my head. Can I bring up, this post that Ed Brubaker, did this last week?
Sure.
Okay, one of our listeners emailed this over to me, but also
Ed Brubaker, creator of Winter Soldier, right?
Which I was about to say,
do this better than you, Jim.
It's okay, but like one of our listeners emailed this over to me. This is part of Ed Brubaker, who's a renowned comic book writer. Wrote this is part of his like newsletter, his own like MailChimp newsletter that he sends out to people, but it's also been picked up since, so maybe folks have seen it. But yes, Ed Brubaker, creator of The Winter Soldier, but something that we, along with Steve Epting, but something that we should say to premise this is like ownership of characters in comic books is so tough and murky, and this is sort of exactly what Ed is going to be talking about here. Mm-hmm. But I just wanted to, like, before I read what he wrote here, just do you have any thoughts about like that complicated context of like identifying a creator of character?
Yeah. Well, it's tough. You always want to mention the artist as well, and then, you know, the colorist, and I think it's sort of like, it's kind of like a movie where you say, you know, Greta Gerwig's Little Women. You know, there are lots of people who work on it. You just kind of, are you talking about just how we reference it as journalists, like casually? Like,
no, I mean, as journalists, and that's a good point. And I almost put this as like a tisking thing on Twitter, but I didn't because I didn't want to sound like too school marmish. But like, as people are more and more having to reference comics and are not familiar writing about them, it is good form to always do writer and artist, because comics are a collaborative thing, and it's not a writer alone in a room that's creating a character. But more just like, I mean, there's a lot of history around this. You think about like Bellfinger, you think about like a bunch of different things. It's hard when you're working in a larger comic book corporation, or other writers pick up your character and like the character becomes something else under that writer. Like, ownership of a character, I imagine, must be kind of a heartbreaking thing as a comic book writer. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So here's Ed. He writes, of course, today the Falcon and the Winter Soldier show debuts on Disney Plus, which I sadly have very mixed feelings about. I'm really happy for Sebastian Stan, who I think is both a great guy and the perfect Bucky/Winter Soldier, and I'm glad to see him getting more screen time finally. Also, Anthony Mackie is amazing as Falcon, and everyone at Marvel Studios that I've ever met, all the way up to Kevin Feige, has been nothing but kind to me. But at the same time, for the most part, all Steve Epting and I have gotten for creating the Winter Soldier and his storyline is a thanks here or there, and over the years, that's become harder and harder to live with. I've even seen higher ups on the publishing side try to take credit for my work a few times, which was pretty galling. So yeah, mixed feelings, and maybe it'll always be like that, but I sure hope not. Work for hire is what it is, and I'm honestly thrilled to have co-created something that's become such a big part of pop culture, or even pop subculture, with all the Bucky Steve slash fiction. And that run on Cap was one of the happiest times of my career, certainly while doing superhero comics. Also, I have a great life as a writer, and much of it is because of Cap and Winter Soldier, bringing so many readers to my other work. But I also can't deny feeling a bit sick to my stomach sometimes when my inbox fills up with people wanting comments on the show. So, I'm sure I'll watch it. And you should too if you're a Marvel Movie Universe fan. But I'll probably be waiting a while to check it out myself, so please don't email me any spoilers, I guess. But go give Sebastian Stan lots of love whenever he's online. So that's Ed's sort of like complicated feelings around. And I thought that was like a really like mature, balanced take, but I was just wondering your reaction.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I hadn't read that, so you dropped some news on me there. And, you know, I thought when he said he had mixed feelings that it was going to be about, like, well, when you are a comic book creator, you're part of a continuum, and it's not even like a writer handing off a script to a director to make into a movie, and then they do their own version of it. I think one of the reasons sometimes writers get cited as the quote-unquote creator of a character is because it kind of starts with the writer, but it's finished by the artist, you know? Like, the character is completed by the artist, and a lot of times the storylines and the personality come from that art. So,
And my understanding is that it's even more collaborative than that. It's not like step one, writer writes all the things. Step two, artist does all the things. It's like, it depends. It honestly depends relationship to relationship.
Yes, it's always in a case. But I'm just saying generally it's kind of like, hey, I have an idea for a spider that's a man. And like, you know, and then, you know, Steve Ditko takes it and, you know, comes up with a look. And then it's a back and forth. It's a tennis match. But, look, I feel sympathy for that. We are all working for companies that make a profit off of what we do, and we get a piece of that at the time, and then that's that. I think they should probably kick him some money, right? Like, bonus as a thank you. Like, here's a gift basket, and instead of being full of pears, it's full of cash. Like, what? I don't know.
Oh, the Harry and David cash basket. It's my favorite
everybody
one.
Loves that. fresh. But
I've heard similar sentiment from other comics creators. So it's just it's an interesting thing because like I most of the Marvel Comics folks that I've ever talked to, they do like the movies, but they have that weird feeling around it. Because it almost feels, because for a while, Marvel, there was like a sort of Maginot line, right, between Marvel Comics and Marvel Studios. And that's more united now under Kevin Feige, the restructuring of Marvel. But like, I think it must have been a weird experience for a while because, especially because what Marvel Studios does is loose adaptations of a comic book story. So they'll take your story if you're a writer. And I'm not saying this is a bad thing that they've done, but I can understand why a writer or an artist who created that story, they have no input, right? So let's say, you know, you and I write a comic that we put our blood, sweat, and tears into, you know, that is a story we're really proud of. And then 10 years from now, Marvel Studios decides they want to do some version of that. They don't have to talk to us about it at all, which is wild, right? Mm-hmm. And that's not how it works elsewhere in storytelling. So just some added info about the complications around adapting comics and you know, how that makes people feel sometimes.
I feel like there should be a mechanism there. Maybe there is now for artists and writers who work for comic books about, you know, hey, if you end up making $1 billion off this character in the future, can you,
well, that's why, slice of it? That's why a lot of comic book creators like leave the big houses to go do indie comics. Cause then you own your character. You know what I mean? Yeah. I think about like Kelly Sue DeConnick, who's one of my favorite comic book creators who, you know, did this great run of Captain Marvel, Carol Danvers of iconic, probably the reason why Marvel Studios wanted to do a film about that character. But you know, then she goes and does like Pretty Deadly and Bitch Planet, like this other stuff that is hers. Mm-hmm. And hearing her talk about those choices, I think it's, you know, it's really interesting to me to, you know, and I really understand why you would want to go off and create something that is yours, you know?
Yeah. It's especially sad when over time, you know, people get older and you hear about like a comics creator who, you know, has a GoFundMe because they're sick. And like they have a character that's generating lots and lots of cash for some company. And,
right.
Yeah. You know. I don't know. I think there should be some sort of a ethical reevaluation at Marvel about this, and I think that's fair, right? Like,
yeah,
just be fair, be generous with people, make them feel good about the work they did.
So
I guess legally
go buy,
you don't have to, but like,
go buy a creator-owned Ed Brubaker comic this week. If you like Winter Soldier, go support Ed Brubaker elsewhere. Yeah, you know,
what's funny is sometimes they would have they would pay people as actors, you know, in like some of the, like the 70s comedies and things like that. Like they would bring in funny friends and they can't pay you as a writer, but I can hire you to play like a bit part and then you can help me write this, you know, on the fly on set. And everybody feels compensated. Like Ed Brubaker had a cameo in The Winter Soldier as one of the people like in Hydra. I don't know that he got paid for that. I don't know what the compensation was there, but they could be like, oh yeah, we're just really paying the hell out of this extra as thank you for, you know, appearing and blessing our work with this. And now, you know, he gets to go home with the nice Easter basket full of dough, full of cash.
All right, so let's talk about another Marvel character created by some folks. This is Robert Morales and Kyle Baker's Isaiah Bradley.
Yeah.
What did you think of the use of the Bradleys, Isaiah and his grandson? We talked about this a little bit. We talked about this last week, but they actually showed up sooner than I thought they would. What did you think of their introduction here?
We didn't get much of a look at the grandson or much from him. He just basically answers the door, then hangs in the background. But Carl Lumley, man, what a great actor. Dude, I just love his work so much on Alias and, correct me, he did the voice of Martian Manhunter for a long time too, didn't he?
And, I think Justice so. League? I think
yeah.
so.
Quick Google search for that. But I thought he also looks way younger than he looks in this episode.
That's what I was telling Richard. I was like, we're going to get a flashback if they put him in that kind of old age makeup for this.
Yeah, because they really aged him up. But like, what a performance in that living room. Like, holy shit. Sorry, we know kids listen, but holy smokes, that is a great...
Holy smokes, Batman.
holy great performance. He was wonderful. I mean, like, so intense and so... Like, you could feel that man's pain, which I think is really hard to pull off when you are reading someone the Riot Act. Like, he is also so angry, and as you can see when he hits that little box and it plows into the wall. Mm-hmm. But I thought the hurt really comes through, and I thought an amazing performance. Mm-hmm. What'd you think?
Oh, yeah, I'm thrilled. I'm so happy Carl Lumley's here. As I said last week, I'm a huge fan of his work on Alias. He was also really good in Dr. Sleep, which I know both of you and I both really liked. And I know he's been on Supergirl, but I don't keep up with that show, so I didn't catch his run on Supergirl. But yes, he did voice Martian Manhunter. Anyway, I'm glad he's here. I'm presuming we're going to get more from him. I would like a whole flashback episode to get the whole story on Isaiah, and I'm hoping we get that.
And you mentioned last week, are we going to see Stanley Tucci's Dr. Erskine? Are we going to see Artem Zola?
Yeah.
I do not think, after watching the original Captain America again, I don't think we're going to get Erskine. I think we'll get Zola, because I think all this is going to happen post-war.
Well, yeah, so as soon as he said Korean War, I was like, oh, my Stanley Tucci dreams up in smoke. Yeah. Right, because Erskine dies, in the 40s. So.
The way Erskine talks in Captain America made me go, oh, he would never have experimented on humans.
No, I didn't think that he would have. I thought he might. But you never know. But, like, I didn't think he would have. But that doesn't mean he can't be, like, sort of involved in scenes around something like that.
Sure. But, I didn't mean to impeach your perspective on the noble Dr. Erskine. I was just like, no, he's too good a guy. Like, he wouldn't do this. But Zola.
Zola, who goes to work for S.H.I.E.L.D. and is part of the whole, like, Hydra infiltrating S.H.I.E.L.D. and stuff like that. I mean, the question is, like, where does this super soldier serum... I really do love saying that every single time, super soldier serum. Where did this stuff that they put in Isaiah Bradley come from? Because Erskine had, that died with him, right? Because...
He was like the key. He had cracked the code.
He had perfected it, and it died with him. And then they tried. You know, they were putting this like janky version into Bucky. I talked before about how in the Marvel Studios universe, Bruce Banner is experimenting with Super Soldier Serum, and that's how we get the Hulk. And they're the other Winter Soldiers, the Winter's Children, people were all super soldiers, but like, and of course in Civil War, Captain America Civil War, we see that Howard Stark had a trunk full of super soldier goop, when he was killed by Bucky, that Bucky like snapped up and took back to Hydra, presumably. So, there's been some goop hanging around.
But super goop is also fun to say, Joanna.
I just like saying goop. It's fun. What is the origin of the goop that they put in Isaiah Bradley in 1951, or the 1950s? I would like to know.
Yeah, I think, look, unlike flying and astral projection, super soldiering is an imprecise science, and it's one of those things that, I think the killing of Erskine, to me, felt like a bit of a narrative device. It's kind of like you've got to break the time machine, because otherwise they could just keep going back until they fix it. And you want Captain America to be unique, and it's not like, inject every nerd in America with this. Every sensitive young fellow out there will become a new super soldier. Like, so you want to break that and make it so that you get only one. So I think like it's the quest to, it's a quest to figure this out, to figure out why sometimes it works. And I think because it's not a science that is easily replicated. Yeah. You get examples like Bucky, you get, Isaiah Bradley. I'm really fascinated to see that story, but also, watching Winter Soldier, they this past weekend, they mention Operation Paperclip. You know Operation Paperclip?
Remind me.
It's a real-life reference to a program that the United States government had. This is not a conspiracy theory. This is a real thing. Basically, to recruit high-functioning, Third Reich scientists and engineers and individuals, these people are brilliant, even though they worked in service of ultimate evil, we're going to bring them over. You get people like Wernher von Braun working on our rocket program, and the ethics of that are extremely unsettling and unclear to some, but maybe crystal clear to others. And Operation Paperclip was a real thing, basically recruit Nazi scientists. And they mentioned it in the context of a Marvel film, it sounds like some made up thing. But with Zola, he's a bad guy. That's not a good guy. He's pretty dark and evil. And so, the fact that he would be willing to do human experiments and create the pain that Isaiah Bradley experienced or was discussing here. That tracks. Erskine doing it? No, because again, he has empathy. He knows what it's like to see his community destroyed by this, and he's not going to destroy someone else. So, I don't think he would have lured Steve Rogers to his lab and injected him if Steve hadn't been like, "I want to do this. Keep going, keep going."
No, I know. I mean, I think there is definitely, it can be interesting to peel back the layer on a character like that who we think of as good and find out that they did some dicey stuff to get there. But I'm with you. Like, I would like to keep Erskine in the good bubble, the good place. And I'm happy to pin all of this on Zola, but we'll find out sort of what happened. But something that he mentions here, something that Isaiah Bradley mentions here, is that he went to jail, I think he said, for 30 years. In the comics, Isaiah Bradley also goes to jail. He's sentenced to life. He only goes for 17 years and then gets a pardon and released. And released essentially because he has dementia and all this sort of stuff like that. The last comic of Truth, Red, White, and Black is a really it's basically Steve finding out about Isaiah, trying to put right what once went wrong, and like going to visit him, and it's sort of like a really beautiful conclusion. That whole book is the whole run is I think I recommended it before. It's not someone on Twitter said this before me, so I will just yes and them. It's not my favorite art that has ever happened in the Marvel universe, but I think the story is really, really strong, and
it has a very like 1920s Art Deco vibe to it. You know, yeah, the art looks very much like something you'd see, you know, the sculptures on the side of a building or Atlas, you know, at 30 Rock. Like, but it's, yeah, I get you.
So, but this idea that, like, the government experiments on black men, has them do some of their dirty work, and then puts them in jail for, you know, as a thanks, is something that was explored in those comics and will be explored here. Isaiah's very justified anger at what happened to him. And I imagine, as you say, Carl Lumley is not actually that old. So we will see, hopefully, him again. All right.
How about the cop scene then outside his house?
All right, hit me with your cop scene feelings.
Look, that's like ripped from our present day, our everyday, and I think it's a little simplified, right? It's a comic book show, but in some ways it is that simple, right? You hear people talk about how often they're stopped for no good reason, and that whole attitude of like, drop your pride, essentially, where Bucky's like, just chill, just, you know, just tell the guy who you are. And Sam doesn't really want to, because why should he have to? Like, that's a real thing. And I thought that was really painful to watch. It hurt to watch. And then the smug cop who, when he realizes he's got a celebrity, acts differently.
Mm-hmm.
That was painful, too. But I was glad to see that there wasn't, you know, propaganda happening on the Winter Soldier, or Falcon and the Winter Soldier. It's just like, you know, I think a nod toward our reality. Now, in your reporting, didn't they do some reshoots over the summer or reconfiguring of the show? Do you think that's one of the things they did, where they realized, oh, this storyline we have actually has some resonance given the George Floyd murder and the Black Lives Matter protest?
Maybe. I've got a little bit more information since that, like, perhaps there was basically a huge overhaul of the scripts. Like, I think effectively they sort of went back to square one at one point. But I think a lot of that going back to square one was done before they started shooting. So my understanding is that they didn't, like, really massively reconfigure, shoot a bunch of stuff and then throw it out and then shoot again. I do have some continuity issues, though. I have questions around, like, I feel like Wyatt Russell's beard kind of comes and go a little bit in this. And I have some questions about, also there's I want to ask you about this other thing. In one scene only, in the plane coming back from Munich, Bucky, who, like, has ripped the arm off his jacket, but now has a hoodie on with two arms on it. I don't know where he got that hoodie, but let's say he borrowed it. Is wearing dog tags, and I have some real, and they're prominently displayed, and they jingle as he walks. It's the only scene that he has them in, and I have some real questions about that. So, okay. So Sebastian...
Bucky? You said Bucky's wearing them?
I said Bucky's wearing them. So, like, so obviously Bucky Barnes was James Buchanan, was in the army with Steve, had dog tags at one point, but, like, where have those dog tags been? Okay, so, and extra textually, Sebastian Stan posted, like, an Instagram story of those dog tags, like, a long time ago, to be like, Falcon the Winter Soldier, sort of, we're back. And they are Bucky's tags. They're not Steve's tags. Someone was like, what are their Steve's tags? And I'm like, I love it. So romantic. Not true. So it's Bucky's tags. They have his sister's address in Indiana on them, right? Because I think that's standard with the dog tag, right? Like, you put the return address on the dog tag so that you can send it to the next of kin. Mm-hmm. But, like, you send the dog tags if you were in possession of the body, right? Not to be indelicate about it, right? But, like, you get the dog tags off the fallen soldier and send them to the loved one, right? No?
Well, all right, kids. Okay. Well, one of the things, I don't know how it's evolved over time, but I know back in the earlier wars, like, I want to say World War II, there's an angle on the dog tag that would be kind of stuck into the body. So there's a reason there are two, is that one would go literally on the remains, and the other, I think, might be returned home. But I know at least there's a reason there are two of them that are identical, and one of them would remain embedded in the body.
Okay. I just But my point is, they didn't have Bucky's body, right? Like, Bucky falls off the train.
No, they didn't.
And then Hydra has him. So, like, let's say he had the dog tags on him when he falls off the train and Hydra has him. Then does Hydra have those dog tags? Or do they have an extra set made and Steve had them? Or do they have an extra set made and send it to his sister? Like, and then why does he have them now? We've never seen him wear them before. And why only in this one scene? I'm stuck on the dog tags. I don't know why they're there in that scene.
This detail, so you could see what was on them? You saw that it was his sister's address? Or
I only saw that because Sebastian Stan posted them on his social media a while ago. So I could take a closer look at them.
Well, he would have still been wearing them when he fell off the train.
Right, so but he was never, like, wearing... Like, did he take them back from... Did Hydra have, like, a storage locker with his effects in them? Like,
here are your things.
You know, like a manila envelope like you get when you leave prison? Like, yeah. I would like the story. Because they really stuck out to me in that. And they were only in... They weren't in... Like, he wasn't wearing them when they were... At least not overtly. Maybe they were tucked under the jacket. Like, on the mission. He's just wearing them on the plane ride back from the mission. And it was just really strange to me. So, I hope it's explained in some way. And it's not just a casual thing that will now drive me insane for the rest of Falcon and the Winter Soldier. But here's the thing. If Steve Rogers had his had Bucky's dog tag somehow. All these years. And gave them back to him.
Hmm.
And we don't get to see that scene, I will lose it.
But he wouldn't have them because they would be on the
body. I agree with you.
The whole point of them being made of metal is that if the body is not recovered right away, they don't. It's not paper that's going to deteriorate or something.
Okay. One other thing I want to mention, a fast running thing. Have you watched the behind the scenes of like how they did the escape scene in Captain America Civil War, where it's Bucky and Black Panther and Captain America, like, sort of running under freeways in that big chase scene in that movie?
Did the behind the scenes of it.
Just sort of the stunt-wise how they did it?
You'll have to refresh my memory. Okay. I remember seeing, footage of that, them leaping across cars and going through the tunnel and all that. But
basically, one of the things they did to make it look really, like, cool is they basically put, like, treadmills down on the concrete and sort of digitally erase them. Like, treadmill trailers being dragged by a car. So, like, the actors and the stunt performers, really, are running on treadmills that are being, like, pulled down the roadway that they're running down, right? Wow. So that's why they look like they're running so fast, because they are, because they're on these, they're not like treadmills you find at the gym. It's like a special rigged up stunt thing, but like, it's essentially a treadmill, right? Mm-hmm. Because I was watching Bucky. At one point, Bucky does some fast running to catch up with the Flag Smasher trucks. And I'm like, why does this look kind of goofy? When I think every time I've seen Steve fast run, it's looked kind of cool. And I was like, oh, because I think this was digitally done versus the like practical effect of Chris Evans stunt double running on a treadmill that's being pulled along a freeway somewhere. I just wanted to flag that fast running effect looked a little janky.
Starts to look a little bit of the Flash. I was on the set of the original Captain America when he breaks out of the lab and and chases the Hydra spy. Oh, I'm blanking on the actor's name. Fellow from The Hobbit.
Oh, yeah.
Movies. But he...
Thorin Oakenshield. I know who you mean.
Yeah. And he's running a little too fast and he doesn't have his sea legs, so to speak. And he like crashes through the window.
Oh, when he's got the when he's got the fake feet on?
He's got the fake feet, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And my interview with Chris was when he was putting on the fake feet. They were so gross and weird. But they had an Olympic runner who was his double, you know, made up to look just like him. And for those scenes where he would be running like from the side or from behind, or maybe at that point they even had a little bit of facial touch up that they could do digitally. They brought in somebody who could really run. They didn't have the treadmills, but like he could really run, and then they would like speed it up just a little bit, maybe. Touch it up a little bit, but they wanted somebody who could book.
I mean, it works. Thing. That scene's really good.
Yeah.
I think
it looks a little more natural than the zip-zip. Like, it starts to look a little, like I said, like the Flash.
Yeah. It looked a little funky, I thought. Richard Armitage. Stop emailing us. We know. It's Richard Armitage.
Yes.
Who's Thorn Oakenshield and also the Hydra Spy and also in the great BBC miniseries North and South. Okay. Just had to get a North and South shout-out in there. Okay. So, last thing that I want to talk about, and then maybe if there's anything you want to talk about, is I just want to really quickly mention, because we didn't do this last week, that Lieutenant Torres, who we meet here, Joaquin Torres, played by Danny Ramirez, is in the comic books, a fairly recent addition to the comic books. And he becomes, when Sam becomes Captain America in the comics, Torres becomes Falcon. Because, get ready, he's genetically infused with the DNA of Red Wing, who in the comics is a literal falcon versus a drone. And he becomes a human falcon hybrid. So Torres became the new Falcon. I'm not saying that that's going to happen for this Torres. I just wanted to flag that this is a comic book character that is known, a known quantity. So,
as a bird lover, I would love to see more animal sidekicks. In the Marvel Cinematic Universe, fewer robotic,
fewer drones.
Drones. I would love to see, now that Red Wing has been smashed, I think let's get that super soldier serum into a consenting,
yes,
red-tailed hawk or falcon
and love it.
Peregrine falcon, and you know, let that creature join the action and then share its magic with Joaquin. I think that'd be great.
Consenting Peregrine Falcon, you heard it here first.
Also, well, you know what I would check? Yeah. You know, do animal, you know, animal experimentation, but like, you know, I don't know. Can you get the Peregrine Falcon's consent to become a super soldier and fight for its country? I don't know. Maybe.
Follow-up question for you. How does the shield maneuver work without super strength?
Oh, well, that's what I was wondering. Is he lying about that? Because John Walker, we see him hurling the shield, and like, all right, like, even if you were a champion discus thrower, like, that's a heavy throw, and you bounce it and catch it. Like, that takes a little bit of strength just not to be like, why doesn't he catch it and then fly across the field? Like,
yeah,
I don't know. Do you think he's lying, that there's a little bit of, like, extra juice in him?
I would think that were it not for the fact that in some of the trailers, we see Sam doing the same thing. He's like practicing with the shield. So I had questions about that from the trailers. So I'm like, how can Sam throw this thing? Like, I feel like it would hit you in the head or something, you know, at the very least, like, you know, you need to have
in a boomerang's back too. Like, it's not just a throw. It's
yeah.
Like, it's like,
and you catch it every time. Like,
where it pings right back to you, like, that takes, okay, all right.
You know, I know the shield is not the same as, like, Thor's hammer, and only, like, the most worthy person can, like, wield it or whatever, but I still think that whole, like, boomerang thing that Cap does that looks so cool, and, like, especially when he and Bucky do it back and forth together, which works because Bucky has super soldier serum in Civil War, like, it's a really cool thing, but, like, Rando John Walker shouldn't be able to do it, right? I don't mean to be a total shield gatekeeper here, but that just strikes me as very weird.
Oh, wizard did it. Oh, I love the mention of the, what is it, the triumvirate, aliens, androids, and wizards.
Yeah, but I thought that was really funny, but then I thought it was weird when John Walker then says it later.
And I, like, think it's just a term in the military. And
it's
that
a
shows
military
that,
term, the big three.
That shows that that Winter Soldier really isn't part of the in-crowd.
But I feel like they wouldn't say wizards. I feel like they would say magic users or something like that. You know what I mean? Well, like, wizards felt like a real Sam Wilson thing to say. I don't know. Yeah.
Last thing I want to mention is the scene outside of, or before, I think it's before they get to Isaiah's house, where there's the kid on the street who's like, hey, it's Black Falcon. And he's like, it's just Falcon. I thought that was a really sweet and funny sequence, and it really moved me because I've been to enough of these Q&As where, you know, we talk about representation and how important it is, and when you see real kids who are seeing themselves on screen as these characters. It's really moving. I remember being at like a panel, moderating a panel for, it was the Agent Carter one shot that they mm-hmm. did. They revealed it at Comic-Con, and there was a kid in the audience, a young black boy, who said, he stood up and his question for Louis D'Esposito, who had, I believe, directed that short.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And is like the co-president of Marvel. He was like, my question is, when are you going to get the Black Panther? And at this point, that movie had not been announced. And Lou, like, he's like, ah, you know, like, how do you disappoint this kid? And he called the kid down and whispered in his ear. And then everybody applauded. And he was like, don't tell anyone. And I've always wondered, like, did he tell that kid the real thing? Like, what did he tell him? Did he say, like, just be patient? Or did he say, like, 2018. Like, I don't know. But I just think of, you know, and my daughter's friends who've talked to me about various characters. And whenever it's a character that they connect with personally, it's always really sweet. So I love that Black Falcon.
I also liked the White Panther or White Wolf joke, right?
Yes, that
like,
was funny.
Sam calls him White Panther and he's like, White Wolf, which is funny because like, so White Wolf is, it was like an end of credit sequence. I forget from which movie. Before Bucky's reveal in Infinity War, whatever came right before Infinity War, basically. Captain Marvel, maybe?
Was it Captain Marvel? Yeah, anyway.
Where you know, you're in Wakanda and all these kids are like, White Wolf, White Wolf. And then like Bucky walks out of his tent, you know, and you're like, yeah, Bucky's all, he's been defrosted. and then it's just never really picked up again. So it was like a nice little moment where he's like, I'm a White Wolf, actually. This is my Wakanda name. But to your point, to that scene, the Falcon scene, that to me felt like the most Anthony Mackie scene, right? Like, I've been watching a lot of these. Basically, they greenlit the show for a number of reasons, but one of which is, I think, off the back of the chemistry between Sebastian Stan and Anthony Mackie in all of their junket interviews, because they're always mm-hmm. paired together. So I've been watching a bunch of these interviews, and like, I think they were really trying to transplant that energy, because it's a very entertaining energy, transplant that energy into like the squabbling, into like the therapy scene and stuff like that. It's a mixed result so far for me, but like, that's what they're going for. That natural chemistry that those two actors have. It just, you can't quite, it's not a quite one-to-one transplant because, Bucky, isn't, Sebastian Stan. Anyway, point being, mm-hmm. that felt like the most Anthony Mackie pure moment for me, that moment. All right. So that's it. We did it. Episode 2, Falcon and Winter Soldier. We'll be back next week. Please do us email stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, Anthony Bresnikan, until then, where can folks find you?
I usually make a little joke here about you can find me at theconsentingfalcon.com, but like, can I give a shout out to, some friends in another podcast who I thought did a really amazing job talking about this same show. So if you have enjoyed us talking about it, you can find me listening to The Spectrum Lounge. It's a podcast run by a great journalist named Rebecca Theodore Vachon. She's known as Film Fatale NYC on Twitter. And she did a show last week, again, called The Spectrum Lounge. Google it. You'll find it. It's a great podcast. She talked to with a fellow geek named Robert Young, who is not just steeped in all of the things that we love about the Marvel Universe, but he also was an Air Force veteran for, I think he said, a couple of decades. So he brings a really interesting perspective to this. I think both of them explore what it means to be black in America and their relationship to this show and what that show says about that experience. I found it to be really wonderful and enlightening, and so I just wanted to give a shout out to them. And, you know, on your left, give them a listen.
they're
really wonderful. I just enjoyed the heck out of that show. So I thought I'd give them a shout on ours, if that's okay.
Of course. Can you, mm-hmm. what's the name of the podcast one more time?
The Spectrum Lounge.
The Spectrum Lounge. Excellent. So we will be back next week. And until then, I don't know.
Where can people find you, Joanna?
Oh, you know, as ever, MannyFerry.com on Twitter @JerRothis. And we will see you next week.
See you next week.
Come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.